goes through. So usually when I give talks, I say, the Perimeter Institute, it's a great place, and you can go to that website, apply for jobs or anything, also at the ITC. What I want to talk about today is this idea of self-testing. So I guess the 3 points I want to get across is, well, why do we want to test? What did we already know, and what's the current status of testing or self-testing of quantum apparatus, or quantum computing, let's say. So why do we want to test? Well, one motivation is quantum cryptography. So there's this quantum cryptographic protocol called BB84, which many people are familiar with, but the details aren't so important. The bottom line is, to do BB84 cryptography, you need some kind of source that says photons in one of four states. And it's important, so you have to provide 2 bits as input, one way or another. So for example, the first bit will tell you which basis, whether you're in the 0-1 basis. And this, if it's 0, it tells you to use some fixed basis labeled by 0 and 1. So this means send a 0 in that one in the 0-1 basis. This means send a 1 in the 0-1 basis. Of course, I have to be able to send information in one of two bases for the same two-dimensional Hilbert space. So the first bit's a 1, I'll send 0 plus 1, and the second bit 0, I'll send 0 plus 1. If I have 1, 1, I'll send 0 minus 1. So you have 4 states living in a two-dimensional Hilbert space, and they have some non-trivial overlap. And quantum cryptography is all about, anyone trying to extract information from the state that's being transmitted. If any non-trivial information is extracted, you can prove that there's some non-trivial disturbance. And once you have eavesdropper detection that's quantifiable, then there's various cryptographic protocols that'll give you, useful cryptographic functionalities. But you need a source that does this. Right? You need to output 4 states which have these non-trivial inner products, non-zero inner products. So you go to the store, you buy this apparatus because you're going to do, secure, unbreakable cryptography, but why should you trust this component?
Does the nomenclature BB84 mean that there's 83 others?
It's a Bennett and Broussard 1984.
Oh, okay.
It's not the 84th version of this provably unbreakable. That would have been a bad idea. Well, why shouldn't you trust it, right? Why shouldn't you just, measure it, get all the right statistics, do a basis change, and make sure you get the right statistics, do sort of tomography of this, process tomography of this apparatus, and believe that it works. Well, what if your apparatus is really doing the following? Right? It outputs 0 when it's supposed to, but in some other degree of freedom, right? This could be time, frequency, position, whatever. It outputs some other information, which I'll label by 0. And it outputs a 1 when it's supposed to, but it also tells you it's outputting a 1. And it outputs 0 plus 1, but also in some other degree of freedom, gives you some other orthogonal information, orthogonal state that tells you it's sending 0 plus 1 and so on. So if your apparatus is just looking at this part of the Hilbert space, you're going to get all the right statistics. The problem is, any eavesdropper or someone who has better technology than you will be able to perfectly distinguish these 4 states. They're actually orthogonal. All the proofs of security break down. And is this really that paranoid? Well, no, actually, I don't think it is. So this information and additional degrees of freedom, it's called a side channel. These additional degrees of freedom are called a side channel by cryptographers. It's been a major problem with classical cryptography. People have been able to break these information on these smart cards or whatever by simply probing, the power, the rate at which power is being consumed. Right? Which, when we idealize the model, we ignore that. We say we're clear, that's tensor product, it's uncorrelated to this information that's coming out of this smart card, but it's not. The time at which bits come out, the precise timing, leaks information about what's going on in the computation, which is supposed to be secure, secret. So side channels have been studied for a long time in classical cryptography. And they'll, of course, be even harder to suppress the quantum cryptography, I think. The first QKD prototype which is really a proof in principle. And this is from John Smolin's website on the history of quantum cryptography. Their side channel was sound. Right? They're somewhere in this apparatus. There's some device which rotated to pick, you know, 0 plus 1 versus the standard basis. And you could hear. It would click for something. And you could actually hear which basis was being selected. So there's another degree of freedom where very important information that's not supposed to be leaked was being leaked. Of course, this was really just a proof in principle. And I think they weren't worried about that at that stage. But the device is actually being sold. I don't think sound is an issue now. But there's certainly reason to worry about other, you know, information being leaked in time degrees of freedom, for example, or position. So we need to make our, so if you want to do something like secure quantum cryptography, we're going to need to make our assumptions and testing procedures explicit. And we're going to have to believe those assumptions. We're going to have to be ready to accept them. I'm not ready to accept that I can, well, at least I can't. Maybe better experimentalists can, but, you know, perfectly realign a beam to be completely overlapping with another beam. Well, I can't. Maybe a good guy could. And they're going to have to argue why I should believe them. And I don't want to, you know, I don't want to rely on some other untrusted apparatus. Because people typically say, well, I'm just going to do a tomography of my apparatus and what it does, and then I'll trust it. That has all sorts of problems. First of all, I'm not sure it works, because your tomography is just going to be on some subset of, you know, some part of the Hilbert space, not the entire Hilbert space. That's one problem. Another problem is, well, why do you trust that apparatus? Who sold you that? Right? There's this loop, right? You somehow want a close, want a self-contained, you know, consistent system in which you can test as much as possible. There's always going to be some sort of assumption somewhere, but we want to, as much as possible, try and keep it all self-contained. Hence the word self-testing. Now, with regard to the cryptography problem, Dominic Myers and Andy Yao devised a scheme for self-testing sources, not operations per se, but just sources for the purposes of quantum key distribution. So they assumed they had, suppose you have some box, right, which is down converting crystals or whatever, that outputs an EPR pair. Well, they proposed a set of experiments, very natural ones, you know, just measuring one basis, just at each site, you know, the Alice and Bob site, pick one of three random bases and perform a projective measurement. Just keep doing that. Do it, you know, 100 times or a few thousand times. Collect all your data on a classical computer, check the statistics, the correlations, and make sure they're consistent with the Bell pair. And if they are exactly consistent with a Bell pair, so if the statistics you get are consistent, then up to local unitaries, you had a Bell pair. So more specifically, you know that this EPR source is outputting some state, joint state of Alice and Bob, which up to local unitaries, so some unitary on Alice and some unitary on Bob, will give us a true, you know, EPR pair. Tensor product, all sorts of junk. Right? This other junk can have all sorts of information. It could be additional EPR pairs, right? Actual down-converting crystals, they don't just output one EPR pair. They output with some probability none, with some probability two, three, and so on. There could be all sorts of other classical information lurking about in Alice and Bob's lab. But that's fine. It's EPR pair, tensor, product, junk. And for convenience, we're going to purify as much of the universe as we have to in order to describe this as a pure state. So they proved this, and this is enough to get, you know, testable QKD, or at least plausibly testable QKD, apart from the fact that EPR sources don't work with very high fidelity right now. So you'd need other assumptions, but let's ignore that. So why does that follow? So we know that this EPR source outputs something which contains in it, lurking about, up to local unitaries, a real EPR pair. So if at this end, and I'm assuming that once this photon, or whatever, enters this half of my lab, it's shielded. So there's no information that's going to accidentally trickle over to the other half of the lab, at least not on any meaningful time scale. So what I do is I pick a random basis here, I do my measurement. If I see a zero, say I measure in the computational basis and the 0-1 basis and I get a zero, then I know that when I trace out Bob's lab, Alice has, up to her local unitary, a zero tensor, some fixed state. And if Bob were to measure a 1, this, of course, could all be going on in Bob's lab. So he's going to prepare his BB84 sources, prepare CPR pairs, measures half of them, and sends on that half to Alice, right? So again, up to the same local unitary, in the same ancilla, there really is a 1 there. He gets 0 plus 1. There really is 0. This plus is really a superposition of that 0 and that 1. Right? They'll have the correct inner product relations with the states he would have sent if he'd measured a 0 or a 1 here, and so on. So there's no, in some sense, because this photon goes in here, I'm assuming, you know, locality of operations, right? I can't superluminally signal or whatever. There's no way for me, due to sheer incompetence, to accidentally encode information in that other photon. Right? With any other system where I just, these so-called prepare and send schemes, I might accidentally, you know, I try to realign the timing, I try to keep everything equal, but I might screw that up. Here I can't, it's almost essentially impossible for me to leak information there if I'm careful. So this is a very, if you're a really paranoid cryptographer, and most are, this seems like a plausible way to prepare your sources. Completely, well not completely, almost completely impractical at present. You can't get rates that people care about. But in principle, this seems like a secure way to do it. So what are the assumptions of Myers and Yap? So they assume locality. By that we mean locality of operations, not, you know, locality of states or anything. So the measurements at A commute with the measurements at B. There's no superluminal signaling or anything. You know, my measurement choice at A is not going to influence what's happening at system A, or system B. Repeatability of experiments. Right? So we're assuming that this apparatus does the same thing every time we use it in an independent experiment. You know, it'd be nice not to have that assumption, because in reality, you know, apparatus erodes and it would have some memory. On the other hand, it's really hard to do science. You can't, you know, repeat your experiments and get statistics. So it'd be nice to be able to relax that one, but we haven't. And lastly, another one, trusted classical apparatus. We're going to try and compartmentalize the problem and worry about testing quantum apparatus. So we're assuming that, you know, when we accumulate the statistics and I'm calculating the probabilities, that I'm not, there isn't some conspiracy, there isn't a virus on my computer or something that's outputting the statistics I want to see and not the actual ones. It'd be really hard to do anything if you don't trust some classical system where you can do your calculation. You don't trust your own mind, right? Then there's not much you can test. So it seems like a strong assumption. On the other hand, you need some variant of it, otherwise you just, you can't do science. Can't even get out of bed in the morning. Now, their results weren't robust. They said, you know, if you get the statistics exactly, then you exactly have an EPR pair. You need some sort of robustness, because you'll never, you know that the statistics are exact. You'll just know that 19 times out of 20 you were within some epsilon of those correct statistics. So they need to be made robust, and hopefully they're efficiently robust. You don't want a small epsilon error in the statistics to blow up to some e to the 1 over epsilon error in the actual operations. But again, assuming robustness, this could be the only way to verifiably, securely prepare BB84 states, or at least with these assumptions. With other plausible assumptions, maybe there's another way. Werner indicated to me that there might have been some other work as well related to CHSH inequalities that might have had some robustness built in there yet, but I haven't had a chance to verify and see how it relates to this. But what else would we want to test? I'm focusing on quantum cryptography, but and especially because the work I'm presenting today is focused on testing circuits and not just sources, not just states. Why would we want to be able to test a circuit, an actual quantum computation? Well, so suppose we're paying a lot of money to perform a large quantum computation, and the answer is not efficiently classically checkable. Right? Very often you can check the answer, like factoring numbers. If the quantum computer produces the factors, you just check it on your classical computer and you're happy. Right. But suppose you have all these experiments going on now in the next 5 to 10 years, measure some physical constants, some amazing precision, and you've got the string theorists and the loop gravity guys and everyone else competing to prove that their theories would make that prediction. Right? The problem is their theories are really hard to compute, and a classical computer just won't be able to make sufficiently precise prediction to confirm their theories and dispel all the other theories. But a quantum computer could. Okay, because these are quantum theories, so it's plausible that my quantum computer can efficiently simulate n equals 4 super Yang Mills theory or whatever. But of course, but there's only one quantum computer in the world. And you think the loop quantum gravity guys paid off the quantum computing guys to get their apparatus to output the results that verify their predictions. So their theory produces the right answer. Right? Yeah. So why should you? So you do this computation, it outputs a number. You can't really check it. You can't produce independent quantum computers and repeat. Because in classical computing, we had the same sort of philosophical problem when we proved the four-color theorem and whatever. Some guys wrote some code and ran it, and it said, yes, the four-color theorem is true. People are like, well, why should I believe that the code was faithfully executed and so on? So should you trust this result if it was the result of a quantum computation? Or suppose you prove that P doesn't equal NP. This is one of the biggest open problems in mathematics, science. So you have a proof that P doesn't equal NP, right? Well, that N doesn't equal NP. Sorry. Yeah. So P is a set of problems you can solve efficiently on a classical computer, and NP is a set of problems you can efficiently verify on a classical computer. So everyone thinks clearly NP is strictly larger than P, but no one can prove it, which is embarrassing, but it's pointing to some some very fundamental difficulties in our current infrastructure. But suppose I have a proof, a very elegant two-page proof that says if P equals NP, then this quantum algorithm will output a bit, this will output 0 or 1 with 50% probability, and if P equals NP, then it'll output 0 with probability 100%. Perfect. That's awesome. Just run the quantum computer. It outputs random bits every time you run it. Therefore, P equals NP. I want my $1 million prize. Will they pay it? I don't know, because it's very easy to get a quantum computer to output random bits. So you'd have to somehow believe that you faithfully executed that algorithm and didn't just rig your quantum apparatus to output the answer you wanted it to output. So if this isn't motivation enough, I don't... No, what is? Okay, so what else was known about testing? So testing sources have been done by Myers and Yao. With Vandana, Manez, and Santa, we developed a series of self-tests for quantum gates. Because we were wondering, quantum computing, you can define a finite set of gates bounded set of qubits that are universal, that can compute anything that's computable, can do any quantum computation possible. So, if I just have to buy 5 or 6 gates, or even 2 gates, or 1 gate actually, and I can compute anything that's computable by a quantum computer. And we wanted to know, can this finite system sort of self-test itself? Can it consistently verify its own behavior? Or is it impossible? Does quantum mechanics simply not allow that? That's sort of the question we wanted to address, or at least I wanted to. We added 3 additional assumptions in addition to what Myers and Yao had. The first one is we assumed we could use the same gate twice or 3 times in the same experiment. Right? Not the most reasonable assumption, depending on your apparatus, but for some schemes, it's reasonable, right? If your gate is just shining a pulse, but if it's a piece of optics, equipment on an optics table, you realize it's non-trivial to you certainly can't move it. And you know, reroute stuff to go through it again, maybe. But we knew this wasn't, ideally we'd like to get rid of it, but it was convenient to leave it there for the time. We assumed you could prepare zeros and ones and measure them faithfully. This, I don't think, was a very big assumption at all. We just left it there, or I did anyway, because I just thought it would make the paper messier to try and, you know, test this as well. I don't think it would have added very much. I think we could have got rid of three without too much effort. The big assumption, you know, or the biggest crutch we used was that the dimension of the physical system stored in qubits was known. We assumed that there really is a two-dimensional Hilbert space in this pipeline, in this channel. It's just two dimensions. There's only two dimensions, right? Which really restricts the kind of conspiracies, the kind of alternative explanations possible are very restricted if you're, you know, promising that it's just a two-dimensional state space. But, you know, with these assumptions, we could prove that a finite set of gates, a universal and fault-tolerant set of quantum gates, could be consistently sort of self-tested. So you could trust that this, you know, phase shifter really was doing a pi over 2, you know, rotation and so on, and this was really doing a ZZ phase shift and whatever it was allegedly doing. You could actually verify it with these assumptions, and then use it to do a larger quantum computation. So what needed to be done? You know, there were some assumptions we weren't so happy with, so we wanted to remove assumptions 3, 4, and 5. But we'd still like to have a composable technique for self-testing a large circuit, right? The beauty of what we did with, you know, Van Damme and Magnez and Santa was you test, you do these tests, you're pretty sure your apparatus does what you think it does, and now I could do a large quantum computation proving P equals NP, or doesn't equal NP, or factoring large numbers, and I can trust it's doing the right thing with high fidelity. If you take away, particularly if you take away assumption 5, and also assumption 3, then there's no guarantee that those gates are going to behave the same in a different experiment. In the same experiment, the repeatability assumption will say it should behave the same. But just because this beam splitter does something when I prepare a photon this way, why is it going to do the same thing when I prepare the photon a different way? It's part of another computation. So this composability is very important, in particular because we want our testing procedure to be efficient. Right, I have a 1,000 gate or a 10,000 gate quantum computation. I don't want to do a tomography of a 10,000 qubit operation, right? Because that requires, you know, more than two to the 10,000 experiments, right? Which is completely impossible. So we'd like the size of the test, the resources necessary for the test, to be polynomial in all the relevant parameters, in the memory, in the number of gates, and so on.
What does tomography mean in this context? I don't really understand what you mentioned a couple times.
Well, just so you have this 2 to the n dimensional Hilbert space, you glue together these small components to do some unitary or super operator, a completely positive map that maps, you know, density matrices and dimension 2 to the n to times 2 to the n to density matrices of the same dimension. And you want to prove that you've done the one you thought you were doing. Right? And I don't want to, you know, prepare exponentially many inputs, do exponentially many measurements to find that, to measure all the parameters of that completely positive map. Right? Because that's just exponential in n, the number of experiments I'd have to do. What I want to do is just locally, you know, test my 2-bit gates and test my 1-bit gates, do some number of experiments that's polynomial in it, and conclude that this circuit was faithfully applied.
Tomography would have been I take a density matrix and I run it through, and I do another one and run it through, and I check it from memory.
Yeah. I just do like an overcomplete basis of inputs, an overcomplete basis of measurements, and then just conclude this must be the super operator that was applied. Which is what they typically do these days, right? Because if they just have 1 and 2 and maybe 4 qubit experiments, takes them hours and sometimes days to do the tomography, but they do it, right? But that's 4 qubits. Any interesting size computation, the tomography is impossible. So, one step in that direction. Well, one thing we can do is combine the Myers-Yao EPR test with our style of gate testing. So, suppose you have this EPR source. You've done all these random measurements. You trust that it's really preparing an EPR state. Then on the Bob branch, you pick a random, you do a random measurement, so you get some random state, which you know. And therefore, you know what state is going into the G gate. If I measure here in the 0, 1 basis, I get a 0. But I know 0 went into the G gate. And then when it comes out, I'm again performing random measurements there. So I'm sending in an overcomplete set of inputs, which I know because I'm measuring here. I'm doing an overcomplete set of measurements, so I will be doing a tomography of G. And if you get all the right statistics, then up to these local unitaries, I am performing G. And I'm performing G solely on this four-dimensional subspace defined by this EPR pair. So it's locally unitary, that G is doing something locally unitary equivalent on inputs that come from this process. I don't know what it's, so this, you know, this photon could be coming in, it's coming in some mode, right, some spatial mode, some frequency, and G does a pi over 2 rotation on photons coming in at that position, right? I don't know what it does if I move the photon over a few nanometers in that same crystal or whatever G is. I don't know what it does there. I just know what it's doing on photons that are coming in exactly this way. This is still not composable, though. It's nice and all, but it's not composable. So I do this test. I verify that I do a tomography of G. I do the same thing for some other gate H. Right, and then I'd like to be able to glue it together and say, therefore, what I get out there is really, G and H composed together in a natural way. But I don't really know that, because I only know what H does on the Hilbert space defined by what comes out of this EPR source. Once it goes through a G gate, it could have shifted over to a completely different Hilbert space, right? So intuitively, this beam, this crystal or whatever, could have shifted the photon over a few nanometers compared to what the EPR source would have sent out into H. And H could be doing something totally different a few nanometers over. So we can't guarantee that the assumption, this technique will compose. So we need something else. In the original work, we did, because we almost assumed that it would compose, because there's only a two-dimensional Hilbert space. There's nowhere to move over. So our goal is to be able to perform, to test the performance of an entire circuit, such as this one. And we'd like to be able to do it efficiently. So these are the actual physical gates, and I want to prove that what they're doing is very close to what the ideal circuit is supposed to be doing. So suppose we want to run this circuit. So the model is, effectively, you have some classical computer, which is controlling your experiment. Some two bits come in, two systems, assuming your qubits come in. Computer tells it to apply G1 to the first qubit and G2 to the second qubit. And then it tells it to apply, G3 to both of them, and send those qubits on, so through the rest of the computation. And I'm assuming that classical control is trusted. There's no side channel information in those classical, in the classical control that's telling the quantum apparatus what to do. Another example, if you're in an optics setup, is you have two qubits, right? You have one photon in this beam, which has two internal states, and this one has two internal states. And this classical computer is maybe controlling, this phase shifter, what parameter phase shift I should apply or whatever. And then maybe controlling the parameters of that crystal, or controlling whether the photons go through it or around it. So it's quite plausible. The locality assumption seems to make a lot of sense in this case. This is what I'm sort of envisaging from an experimental point of view. One other major challenge in the work with Magnez et al. And Van Damme et al., what we did is we had a finite set of tests, right, which had it used at most, 5 or 6 gates per experiment. Once you tested it, you could conclude that these gates would perform faithfully in an arbitrarily large circuit. But with this new, more paranoid set of assumptions, you can't assume that. Because the gates can pass on, explain. So this circuit here that you're applying, you have this qubit that comes in, G1 faithfully applies G1 to this apparatus here, faithfully does what it's supposed to, but then in some other degree of freedom, it writes down, okay, I received the qubit, and this is what I did to it, and passes that information on to this new system at G3, which is that crystal. So this crystal gets all this classical information in the side channel. So it knows that G1 was applied to the first qubit, G2 was applied to the second qubit, and it knows it's supposed to apply G3. It also knows the procedure you're using to test your system. So it can say, well, this looks like it's part of the test, because there's a finite set of tests. So what it does is it does what it's supposed to do. It applies G3 and just keeps writing on that transcript and says, okay, qubit 1 had G1 and G2 applied to it, I just applied G3, you know, good luck. And you just keep doing this until some gate realizes this is no longer part of a test. Once the circuit's big enough, eventually you will reach a part of the circuit where it can look back at its history, the history of its inputs, its sort of, you know, backwards light cone, and say, oh, this is not a test. Now it can do whatever it likes, because it knows it's not being tested. Right? So that was a bit depressing. We're like, how the heck are we going to do that? How are we going to make testing possible? Or maybe it's not possible. But what it indicated to us is that we needed that every possible circuit had to be a possible test. You couldn't have just some finite set of circuits and then test for any possible computation. Every possible computation has to be part of the test, which led us to the following framework for testing. Suppose you want to implement this circuit. Well, what we would do is the following. You prepare, if it's a two-qubit circuit, you prepare two EPR pairs and spatially separate each half. So imagine there's a wall between here, so there's no communication from this half of the computation to this half, ever. Right, except for the classical computer that's collecting data on both sides. Verify your initial sources so you know you have, you know, legitimate EPR pairs. Do your tomographies of G1 and G2. So you know you have G1 and G2 on some subspace. Invert, do G dagger, or G transpose on this other side, and then verify that you have EPR pairs again. This is going to allow us to prepare inputs, faithful inputs, to the next layer. So we have two EPR pairs again. I can now do my tomography of G3, the G3 gate, and so on. And I can kind of grow the test. I test the circuit piece by piece as I go along. I invert G3, and then I could, you know, keep on testing it as part of a bigger circuit. This is how you can test whether that this circuit is being faithfully applied. The one important technical problem is, usually in quantum computing, you don't want a random input. A random input is usually, yes?
In this, aren't we assuming that we have G1, G2, and G3 dagger faithfully?
No, it's effectively we're testing that as well.
Okay, so it kind of tests both
at once? Yeah, because effectively, once you've tested this, you know, you can check these statistics. You effectively have an EPR pair in this weird basis conjugated by G1. So when we do apply G dagger and get back, you know, EPR pairs, we know we actually have, that was really on that subspace, G dagger or G transpose. So there's no assumptions. It's something we're implicitly testing as well. Now, so most quantum computations need to be done on a specific input. I don't know of any examples offhand where applying a known circuit to a random input gives you the kind of answer you're looking for. Maybe it is possible to do that, to convert any circuit that works only on all zeros and get it to work on a random string. It's possible, but I could see if you bias the input a little bit, do some data compression, pair some clean qubits and so on, but I stopped thinking of that when I thought of the following idea. What you could do is prepare EPR pairs, measure in the computational basis. If you get zero, do the identity, and if you get one, apply an X gate, flip zero to one, or one to zero, so on. And same thing with the other qubit, right? And that sort of is how we usually prepare zeros. You prepare a qubit, you measure it. If it's zero, leave it alone. If it's one, flip it. This is all controlled by a classical computer. So this system doesn't really know why it's being told to apply an X gate or an identity gate. The classical computer knows why, but we're assuming, again, there's no side channels in this classical control. So you run this computation. This effectively does the computation you want it to do. And then you go through and you piece by piece verify this new circuit, which has some X gates at the beginning. So this is a whole bunch of experiments we're doing. Each of these, you know, overheads present a different experiment. Apart from this first one, which you need to do first, these you can do in random order. You don't really care. So if you get all the right statistics, then you know that you did the right computation here. Okay, why am I worried about this classical control? Okay, you could just have said, well, if you want 0, 0, just keep doing this EPR thing until you get 0, 0 on the other side. Right? The problem with that is, of course, it's fine if you only want two zeros, but once I want n zeros as my input, I'm going to have to repeat on the order of 2 to the n times before I get the right input, which, you know, which is not efficient. It's not going to be plausible for large quantum computations. If the quantum computation has small memory, but a lot of gates, then it is feasible. But not all, you know, that's not going to give us enough power, really, for full quantum computation. Not likely. Not if there's unitaries. So that's why we went through all this fuss figuring out how to compare 0-0 inputs. So before I give you the bottom line, because what I'm going to show you is that this is an efficient procedure. Some technical points which we discussed in detail in our paper. First of all, this procedure only tests real gates and real states. By real, I mean with real coefficients. Trying to verify complex coefficients, that you really have a state, you know, 0 plus I1, and you have some gate with complex amplitudes in it, has proved to be really tricky. We wanted to, but we gave up, or at least postponed those efforts. Now, we're not assuming the gates are real. It's not like we're saying, well, if you promise me the gates are real, then they're the right ones. We're assuming they're complex, but we're only going to verify real gates for you. If you ask me to verify a complex gate, I'll say I don't want to do that. So we don't have a procedure, a general procedure that works with non-real coefficients. Not yet. It's not because we didn't try. So just to get a flavor for why it's so elusive is, you know, one complex bit can be simulated by two real bits in a very natural way. So you think you're doing this one qubit experiment. This one qubit complex experiment, you know, where 0 goes to 0 plus I1, for example, and then you do some other experiment where it goes to 1, right? In reality, what might be happening is this is 0, 0, and then you go to 0, 0 plus 1, 1, where the second qubit is telling you whether you're imaginary or real. And this can be done in a very consistent way. So you get all the right measurement statistics and everything at the end. Of course, your measurement is part of the conspiracy as well. So there's a two-bit real simulation for one complex bit, which is not equivalent according to our notion of equivalence. These two are not unitarily equivalent, which means that inner products aren't preserved. Right? So I could be sending you BB84, something that behaves like a BB84 state, with these, you know, appropriate inter-product relations that I mentioned at the beginning. But in the real case, they're actually more distinguishable than they're supposed to be. And someone who has more sophisticated measurement apparatus can actually distinguish your states with better, you know, fidelity than they're supposed to be able to. So this seemed like a problem. So we kind of gave up on the complex case for now. So quickly sketch our approach. We have two notions, simulation and equivalence. Equivalence just is like this kind of equivalence. You get the right statistics. That's simulation. So simulation means you get the right statistics. Equivalence means this local unitary equivalence that we really want. So let me precisely state our theorem, one of our main theorems anyway. So suppose you have a k gate, a quantum computation with k gates. I mean, x is a string, which is the input you want to run this computation on. Epsilon and gamma are parameters, precision parameters. If our procedure, which is the one I sketched, right, on all those gates with that input and those specified probabilities, tells you that, you know, everything went A-OK, then you know that with probability 1 minus big O of gamma, the probability distribution that you get when you measure your answers at the end is within this variation distance, right? K plus N, so K is the number of gates, N is the number of qubits, epsilon 1 over 8, so epsilon is that parameter that you were given. So clearly you want epsilon to be really small compared to K plus N. So this number is really, really small. So by picking epsilon small enough, you can guarantee that the outputs you get are really, really close to what you're supposed to get. And for, as a computer scientist, the most important thing we care about, the most important thing is that it's possible to do it in polynomial, with essentially polynomial resources. The number of experiments scales very nicely with K, scales pretty nicely with N, roughly N log N. Polynomially in 1 over epsilon. I think epsilon to the 1 over 8 is probably the best we could have hoped for. So within a polynomial factor, this seems about the best we could have hoped for.
What's N?
N is the number of qubits in the computation, the total memory requirement. So to us, it was very reassuring, comforting to know that at least it's possible to efficiently test the system with these, you know, reasonable assumptions, non-trivial assumptions, or to test their behavior, right? Because initially I thought it wasn't possible. There's no, you know, because of all these counterexamples we were coming up with, I thought you just can't self-test without imposing some additional assumptions. Ideally in physics, we'd like to have as few assumptions as possible and just kind of direct, you know, actually experimentally test everything from some very basic primitive assumptions. And not just, you know, have to trust everybody. Especially if you're doing foundations of you know, quantum mechanics. You want to assume as little as possible and just kind of verify things from very simple, plausible assumptions. So for theorists, we were delighted because it's polynomial. The assumptions aren't that ridiculous. As an experimentalist, this is not really that feasible. These constants and the number of, you know, epsilon to the epsilon 1 over 8, that's quite a hit to tell the experimentalist who wants to verify that his or her source, you know, is within, you know, 1 over 2 to the 6 or whatever of a real EPR pair. So, but to get 2 to the 6, you're going to have to get 1 over 2 to the, you know, 48 precision in your actual experiment for me to conclude that's within 1 over 2 to the 6. This is all roughly just constants floating around here, but that's the idea. It's a heck of a lot of precision to ask for the experimentalist to achieve, right? We don't have EPR sources that work with fidelity close to 1. We don't have detectors that work with fidelity close to 1. So there's, a, you know, for the current practitioner of this experimentalist, this is not close enough. But for a computer scientist, we're delighted that at least it's polynomial, because if it was exponential, then it would be absolutely hopeless to verify your apparatus with these assumptions. You would need stronger assumptions, which maybe you're less inclined to believe. So some of the open problems and future directions I'm interested in are to apply these techniques to actual experiments. And I think for the most part, but we have to talk more with them, look at big constants in more detail, we're going to have to modify these techniques. We're going to have to say, okay, look, I'm ready to believe something else, which will probably be specific to your experiment. What those additional assumptions that we're ready to believe are, I don't know yet. If you want something that'll work, you know, if you want to work with the current EPR sources, the current detectors, we're going to need additional assumptions. So if you're ready to assume something about your detectors, or maybe there's something randomization can do for you, if they don't know what order your experiments are being done. You know, improving the asymptotics, so can we get epsilon to the 1 over 8 to be epsilon to the, you know, root 2 or square root of epsilon or something. The current QKD prototypes people are sending are not, don't do this. They don't prepare EPR pairs and so on. They actually just, they start with a qubit, they do one of four things to it, and they send it out. Right? So there's all sorts, in this framework, you can totally foil the system. But for any specific implementation, can we add some additional assumptions and things that are testable to produce something that is plausibly reliable QKD. And I'm all very interested in this complex case, because the conspiracy I just described here is actually local. When you try to scale it, you know, N complex can be simulated by N plus 1 real bits. But that extra one bit, the one that, you know, tells you whether you're complex, you know, real or imaginary, it has to be everywhere all the time. So it's not a local conspiracy. If I spatially separate these qubits, this conspiracy won't work, right? But I can't find another conspiracy that will work, and I can't prove that there is no conspiracy, so we're kind of something I'm working on mapping. Okay. And there are my sponsors. Well, that's the end of my talk then. Thanks a lot for your attention.
The case you have, you use all users entanglement as the basis to check the internet. Is there any other suggestion of, without using entanglement? And still prove that it is quantum mechanical?
Not with these assumptions. I think with these assumptions, I doubt it. If you're willing to believe something else, like entanglement is our main ingredient, right? So if we lose that, we're back to the drawing board. I think we need to, you know, impose some other really arrogant, implausible, well, I don't know, maybe plausible, but a really, you know, trust me, I know I'm a physicist, I know what I know my Hilbert space. Not only do I know my Hilbert space, I know my operation space.
In all the quantum crypto systems that are for sale today, none of them use quantum crypto based on entanglement.
Right.
Does that mean, from your point of view, none of them are safe? Could ever be thought?
So I carefully reworded this one.
They're all being sued by.
Yeah, well, that's
all they recorded, so.
Where are they? Coming up. So this might be the only way, with these assumptions, to verifiably securely prepare. You might be securely preparing, but how are you going to convince someone else that you are? Like that. So I want a procedure that I can tell to somebody who's not one of the leading optics experimentalists in the world that this is faithfully preparing, you know, non-orthogonal states. And how are you going to do that? Do that under, you know, real conditions, right? You don't want something that works with, you know, where all the grad students are very careful not to touch the table, and the temperature's controlled to within, you know, half a degree Celsius. You put it out in the field and the temperature's fluctuating and the pad lengths are changing and all this other stuff's going on, and you still want it to be, you want the failure modes to fail and not to say, oh, sorry, I'm not working, and you don't want them to just be sending out four orthogonal states.
So you, as a paranoid photographer, you would use quantum crypto only based on entanglement?
Right now, yes. So I think there's hope for, you know, we can add some kind of reasonable assumptions about what's going on in these crystals. For example, like, you look in them and it doesn't look like there's a computer in there managing this conspiracy, right? You might be able to use some sort of complexity theoretic arguments and say, well, the conspiracies necessary would require, you know, a lot of computation, right? And then use some Bekenstein bound to say that there's not enough room in that crystal to carry out that computation. I mean, hopefully you don't have to be that paranoid. But it'd be nice to say that, come up with some framework which would encapsulate the kind of conspiracies going on in these crystals which are, I can look at and so on, and say, well, in that framework, this is secure.
So should I conclude that you're not a hidden variable person?
Yeah. Why would you conclude?
Because there is a computer inside these crystals. They are made of all these hidden variables.
Oh, right, yeah. That's right. So, I mean, I believe in hidden variables, but they have to fit in the crystal, right? I believe in black holes and other things. So So you can only cram so much, so big a conspiracy in a tiny volume. But yeah, I think the Bekenstein gun would get ridiculously, it'd still fit a heck of a big conspiracy in that. So you need some other system. Some other reasonable argument to say that there is a too sophisticated conspiracy going on.
More questions? With all your variables around the table, we should probably
Yeah.
That point. Thank you.